Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes on the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio every second Saturday, 4 to 6 Eastern Time. It's the 26th of June today, 2010, year 2010. Well, a lot happening in the world, and chaotic times and major serious problems facing humankind, with everything from the Gulf oil volcano and to the threats of the gases from this and the possibility of hurricanes in the Gulf to spread these poisons around further, the amassing of emergency services and such outside of the state, the Gulf states, the kind of obstruction of the media and of people knowing what's going on, and the handicapping of efforts to deal with this massive oil spill. These are terrible, terrible problems, and people all along the Gulf are losing their way of life, and this is a huge loss to America and to the larger world if these problems can't be dealt with. So we're facing huge problems in the Gulf and economic problems and more job losses and people losing their homes and other all kinds of deviant things being done. And thinking of people who lose their homes, which are kind of claimed and they're forced out, and in different ways people are having their land and property seized and being forced to move and things along this line. There's so really so much happening in the world, and we'll talk about these things and other things today. Usually the focus of the Zero Point Show is trying to explore mystical and spiritual teachings in the area of psychology and science. Two of the most important concepts of the radio show and teaching is firstly that human consciousness doesn't originate out of the brain in the head of a human being, but instead human beings are actually ensouled by higher dimensional forces. A human being is ensouled through the human heart. That a human person's, the origin of consciousness within the person and the origin of the I experience in the human being originates out of the heart. And that there's actually a physics to the heart, and in fact a higher dimensional holographic metaphysics to the human heart. The human heart, human beings have this secret nature. Our heart is related to our soul, the soul life in human beings. And in mystical teachings, the experience of self-realization involves this awakening within the human heart and the attainment of this fundamental I experience within the heart. And this self within the heart is described as self-illuminating like the sun. And in different mystical traditions, it's described differently. In Gnostic Christianity and Kabbalah, it's described as a divine spark. Sufis similarly refer to a God spark or a divine spark. Blavatsky refers to a monad. The Vedas refer to the Jiva Atma. Okay, so the idea is that there's a spiritual spark or principle within the heart, and the heart is seen as the cave of Brahman. Brahman is a Vedic term for God, like the cave of God. And Christ is said to be within the heart. Lord Krishna is said to be within the heart. The Dalai Lama describes the indestructible drop as within the heart. The Jewish saying states that the truth is under our noses all the time. And if you think of what's under your noses, in a way, it's your heart, and that is your true center within the heart. And the mind in the head, the brain, and the acquired personality and its conditioning and so on, that's more the false ego centered in the mind, in the head. The self within the heart is regarded as the sun of the body, while the mind in the head is regarded as the moon, because the moon has no light of its own. It's only illuminated by the light of the sun. And similarly, within the human being, the sun element is said to be within the lotus of the heart. And the more a person's consciousness abides within the heart, then the more they are inwardly illuminated by the light of this self. You can have different kinds of experiences of states of samadhi and of expanded consciousness and the experience within higher centers. So the next level of evolution in human beings, according to varied occult teachings, is the awakening of the heart chakra, whereas the old world order, in a sense, has been based on the three lower chakras and governed by people, men and women, obsessed with money, sex, and power, such that their desire for power leads them to want to have a one-world government under their control, where they can have an almost total surveillance society and own everything themselves and chip people and put them in cities and confine them and limit their freedoms. While in a way they win the monopoly game and they own everything. And these people believe one of their biggest threats, they believe, it is the world's population. There are too many people on the world. They actually believe they have some kind of right to murder people or to spread sickness among people. They think that's okay to do that, you know, if it furthers their desire for world control and domination. We have these multinational companies that dominate different markets and put honorable people out of businesses and shut down. They want to stop natural food products. And in the States, they want to limit gardening so you can't garden. And they spray you with chemtrails all across the nation, spraying everyone with aluminum and barium and heavy metals, other viral matter. They can experiment on you now. And meanwhile, your militaries are over fighting wars based on lies and fraud and serving the elites of the world, not serving the American people, not protecting America. America has become this dominant world military power and threatening people all around the world and initiating new wars. And now they're going to perhaps proceed with another mass execution of people in Iran. On the fraud of Iran might get a nuclear weapon, while all the other countries there are armed with hundreds of nuclear weapons. It is so insane. We have the UN and the NATO are lying to their countries and pretend to serve humankind, but they're based on lies. People know, in the world know now, that 9/11 wasn't done by 18 Muslim men hijacking airplanes. It was a fraud. And it's a complex cabal of criminals and thugs and Zionists and Jesuits and neo-Nazis and so diverse kind of criminal groups that have done these things within our society. We're in a very, very precarious times. And now new evidence is emerging from the Gulf that this may well have been another 9/11 staged event. That if one looks at the positioning of Goldman Sachs and Halliburton and other companies, they're selling off their stocks in BP and positioning themselves in different ways and buying up the company that sells dispersants and having all this kind of stock manipulation and preparation ahead of time. And then there's so many questions about what's really happening in the Gulf. Even now they're questioning if these videos we're seeing are really simply concocted in a media studio. How do we really know that these are the true videos of what's happening a mile below the level of the surface of the water? There are so many lies and there, people don't understand the threats inherent to this situation. And these dispersants are simply adding to the problems, and the government and BP seem to be obstructing people dealing with these immense problems in the Gulf. If you have a piece of paper, take down this name. And this is a woman who lives in Louisiana, and there's a 10 to 15 minute presentation of her impassioned speech. And she had been able to get into the inner circles of the BP crews dealing with the Gulf issues. And she was witnessing really what was going on there and how nothing was being done, and the media were being deceived, and they had a dog and pony show going on, something along that line, just deceiving the public as to how much they were coping with this terrible disaster and what's really behind it. And more evidence is emerging concerning that there was actually explosives or some type of weaponry used to intentionally blow up this rig to create these problems. Shows on Don Nikoloff this week and on True Ops show through Micro Effects and other investigative show, Alex Jones, all these people now, there's such evidences that there's more here than meets the eye. And how is this all a Ponzi scheme? You know, a deceit of the public to try to bring in new cap and trade system and laws and so on. So it's all needs to be investigated. This woman, Kendra Arneson, is her name, from Louisiana. Kendra, K-I-N-D-R-A. Her last name, A-R-N-E-S-E-N. And I urge people to listen to this woman's impassioned plea for people to help do something, and to that somehow people have to come together to take control in these situations, because what is being done is criminal. I thought when I heard her speech, she talked about how she had to witness the people around her, everybody she loves, because she lives on the very out end of a part of Louisiana in one of the parishes, and everybody's being poisoned by these gases, and it's all this denial, and nothing is being done to prevent this oil coming into the wetlands there. And listening to her speech, I felt it was like a call to arms. In a way, it's like a call to arms to Americans. Like, when do we say enough is enough? You know, how far will the American people be abused by a government, not only in the Gulf, but in every aspect of what is being done? The way the government wants to shut down the internet and have powers to do that, and to enforce inoculations, and carry the flu hoaxes on, and the global warming hoaxes on. All these hoaxes perpetrated on the American public. The bailouts, giving billions and trillions of dollars to foreign banking interests, all putting the tax burden on the American people. They're impoverishing nations. And this has been after over a 50-year effort to attain zero growth in the United States, to undermine its industrial and manufacturing sectors, to bring down the United States, which has long been seen as a major obstacle to world government. So many things are being attacked. People are being attacked on so many levels at once. We live in a chaotic and dangerous times. And there's at the same time signs of hope, and I quote Brzezinski, who is one of the main intellectual forces behind, tied into these elite groups and behind Obama, and really he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And in Montreal, a month ago at a CFR meeting, he noted the danger of there being a global political awakening, and that he described this as one of the most dramatic and significant developments in geopolitics that has ever occurred. See, that's what's realizing. It's like the people around the world, we're realizing, my God, our nations have been hijacked. And there are groups fashioning to bring about totalitarian state. And there are people who actually believe in genocide and eugenics and having control of the masses, who don't respect human life, who create one after another scene of chaos. And these people now have advanced forms of weaponry, and we really don't understand what's all being done. Like, what are all the reasons for chemtrailing, and who exactly is doing that? And how HAARP is being used, and whether any of these earth anomalies and upheaval are being done intentionally. Like, these are becoming questions all over the internet, and serious researchers trying to look at these things and understand it. You know, why does Haiti have an earthquake 2 weeks after they walk away from the Copenhagen agreements? And why does Brazil have an earthquake 2 weeks after they offered to help Iran sell processed uranium to Iran for electrical needs to try to mediate the Middle East threat? And then Brazil has an earthquake. These and other events, people now beginning to wonder, are these people, how much are they controlling the weather? How 1 week you have like 26 tornadoes, I think it was in Nebraska or some Midwest state. You know, we just don't know these things, and we can't put any, these people have this arsenal of weaponry that they can use upon the population. We're in very serious times, and in a way, they're such egomaniacs and have no respect for human life. I only woke up years ago, and I was never been politically oriented through my life because of my interest in mystical teachings and science and such. And what woke me up was learning the truth of 9/11. And then you see more and more how many of these things have been false flag events. The bombings in the London subway, the bombings in Spain, Oklahoma City bombings. You can see it when they have mass shootings to get their gun laws. So many of these events are staged, and we're lied to consistently by the corporate media, all controlled by these various groups. Humankind has been brainwashed and fed propaganda and distracted from what's really happening within our nations. And now, fortunately, there's this beginnings of a global awakening. Well, hopefully this is what we need to precipitate and be part of. David Icke has an interesting new book. It's called Human Race, Get Off Your Knees. The lion sleeps no more. And in a way, there is this awakening happening around the world that people are realizing the criminality of these international bankers and people trying to subversively bring about this one world government, enabling the elites of the world to have more and more power and control of the lives of ordinary people. Undermining their constitutional rights and other bills of rights and so on. We don't want to slip into a fascist state and a surveillance state as Brzezinski would have for us. I thought this talk of this woman, Kendra Arneson, I would encourage people, put in her name into YouTube and put in Gulf Crisis, and you're bound to arrive at her impassioned speech. I thought this was like a call to arms almost. It's like where that fellow in the Network movies opens up his window and he says, we're not going to take it anymore. We're sick and tired of this. We have a right to have non-corrupted governments. We have a right to have governments that serve us, like serve the population instead of serving themselves and foreign sources. the state of our nations is really just most shocking. What has become of us? What has become of our civilization? You turn on the media and you see more and more pornography, random violence, criminality, greed, justification of torture, and all these things, surveillance, all part of mind control, all going back to the Tavistock Institute and other roundtable groups that are fashioned to control and control the media and spread this propaganda, undermining spiritual values in our society, undermining any efforts towards world peace. Why does mankind never grow up? Why do we have these mass wars now all around the world? And it's just getting worse with more and more extreme weapons. You know, people are being killed in Pakistan by drones controlled out of Texas. Someone with a joystick who finds joy somehow in mass murdering innocent families and community members, all supposedly, you know, rescuing us from the Taliban. The true terrorists of modern times are within our own society. And we have to smell these people out. And I'll overturn these rocks and they'll come out like bugs hidden in the dark. They don't like the light, the growing light of consciousness and awareness of humankind as to what's being done in our societies. We somehow have to rise to the occasion and oppose these satanic and Luciferian forces that have managed these things in our society. So I wanted to just share some of my thoughts on our situation at the moment, encourage listeners to listen to Don Nikoloff's show through the week, Evident Footprints. He's at the very forefront of kind of new revelations and pertaining to the Gulf and just this growing awakeness that we have to foster, this political awareness and awakening of humankind that Brzezinski so fears for these people. We see at the moment in Canada, they have the G20 in Toronto spending over $1 billion of taxpayer money to protect these interlocking groups of criminals from our countries. They don't go and meet there and serve us. They go there to conspire. They conspire and they present a series of lies publicly, spending public funds and impoverishing people more and more for the international corporate and banking elites. These people, our governments, are no longer serving ourselves. It's outrageous what is happening. We have a war in Afghanistan, and Canadian troops in Afghanistan, all based on lies. Had nothing to do with protecting America from Osama bin Laden and his reindeer. That was all a lie. It was made up. It was sold through the media. All your senators and House representatives, all these levels live in denial of that. And people are afraid to speak the truth. What have we become as nations? What's been done over the last decades? All the wars and torture and terrorism propagated around the world by the CIA and the Mossad and British intelligence and these elites of the world. How many lies do they have to tell? How many more mass murders do they have to perform? It's astonishing that the life of humankind, we never made it to the fourth chakra, the heart chakra, the awakening and awakening of the heart and feeling love and compassion for people around the world. They're all our brothers and sisters. When those children die in Afghanistan and Iraq, they're your brothers and sisters and children because we are all of one race. How can we have let these aliens somehow interpenetrate and take over our society to this extent? It's really quite an astonishing tale and an astonishing time. Okay, so that's my ramblings and opening comments, and we have two guests coming on today. One is going to be coming on in a few minutes, who I'll introduce in a minute, and then we'll have a second guest, I hope, for the second hour of the show. But first, I'd like to step back and welcome my co-host, Jim Moffitt. Hi, Jim, how are you?
Good, how are you, Chris?
Okay. So you're there in the midst of the G8, Jim. Do you feel there's any intrusion into your rights as a citizen by this, however you would like to describe it? What's it like being in Toronto?
Well, I mean, it's completely disruptive. It's in terms of what it's done to the life in the downtown and the city. It's funny because the whole thrust of everything is pretty much stopped all business activity, disrupted people who live downtown like to an incredible extent. And I was wondering, like, how could a terrorist attack be worse than this? You know, like, I mean, it's the cure is worse than the disease it's supposed to prevent. And I just find it, you know, it's very odd. It's very interesting that the bill that's officially been announced, which you know is going to be an underestimation of what it's really cost, is $1.3 billion for security for this little conclave that these guys have called together. They don't seem to have ever heard of video conferencing or, you know, buy a webcam, you guys, you know, and get on it if you really want to talk. And it's really just a photo opportunity. And the interesting thing that's occurred here is that people of every political persuasion of the spectrum from right to left are all pretty much outraged that Canadian tax money has been spent this way. It's actually very interesting to observe it on that level. There's protesters down on University Avenue today. There was apparently some throwing of various things at police, and that was about an hour and a half ago that I heard, but I'm not sure what the status of that. It was apparently a small group, but I mean, you know, whenever something like that happens, my first thought is that there are always some yahoos at these things that want to have a confrontation with the cops, but there are also always some undercover cops who want to provoke a confrontation. You know that there are guys there that are probably agent provocateurs who are involved in this. So, you know,
because they want to obscure the real issues here. And
well, they want an excuse to come down on people. But what's really interesting is that, you know, that I've been listening, I've been following, like, the preparations in terms of people organizing the protests. And, you know, what's really clear is that they've created a real climate of intimidation, you know, in terms of, like, trying to scare people in terms of, you know, you will be arrested if you do this, really, I mean, I just heard a police spokesman on saying, you know, that people definitely have a right to protest and exercise their democratic rights, the free speech. And everything. It was a good speech that he made, basically, but the whole climate leading up to it has really been anything but that. It's like, they're certainly not encouraging people to, you know, go down and protest this fiasco, which is what it is. I mean, the whole thing is a complete joke. So it's, you know, it's discouraging, but what I say, I think is heartening is that, as I say, response across the political spectrum, $1.3 billion, you know, we have a lot of people out of work in this country. We don't have enough money for our healthcare system. We don't spend enough on research and development to improve our economy. We don't have enough daycare spots. We don't have, you know, I mean, like the needs. We don't have enough affordable housing for people. I mean, that, you know, $1.3 billion, you know, it reminds me years ago of Everett Dirksen, the senator from Illinois, talking about the cost of the Vietnam War, said, you know, a million here, a million there, pretty soon you're talking about serious money, you know, and I mean, that's basically, now it's a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking about serious money, like $1 billion, $1.3 billion to have these guys for a few days come, talk, come out and have their pictures taken, and then make some phony pronouncement about, you know, how they're promoting fiscal responsibility amongst governments and economic cooperation. The whole thing is just so transparently ludicrous that it's just revolting, you know. The whole thing is revolting. That's, you know, very, very disturbing.
Yeah, it is disturbing, and I see it as it's an opportunity for mob bosses to conspire. That's how I see it. Because these people aren't serving the people anymore, and they're not. Why can't they be more open about? Why can't these hearings be public so we can see what our so-called representatives are saying and formulating?
That presupposes that these guys ever represented people. I don't have that view of history at all. I mean, I don't see anything unusual about this. I think it's more of the same. What's disturbing is that there's such a concentration of economic power amongst fewer and fewer hands. And I mean, I don't agree with your analysis of what that exists, but it certainly exists throughout the world, and there are all sorts of various unseen forces that are manipulating things and they use these people. Like, I don't know, I sent you that article. It was a very good article in Rolling Stone magazine about the hearings that on bank reform in the United States. Well, all of a sudden, 3,000 bank lobbyists descended on Washington, and you know, any transparency that was hoped for, that was to be put forward in the financial reform bill, was quickly taken away. So, you know, I mean, you have Tea Party people who say, well, they're outraged about the bailouts of these companies, but at the same time, they don't want government interference in things. Well, I mean, that's just logically inconsistent. The whole reason that these people can get away with the things that they've gotten away with in the last 25 years is because there's no regulation of the financial industry. You shouldn't be allowed to make these trades sub rosa. You should be transparency. It should be public information what these people are doing. They're not producing anything. They're not making anything of any value. They're just manipulating things to make money for themselves. And until there's bank regulations with real teeth on it, it's going to happen again. You don't have to be a political economist or an expert. I'll tell you right now. You know, mark this date. What is it? 26th of June? I'll tell you right now. This is going to happen again. There's going to be another huge crash because these guys are going to get away with it again. And there's no accounting for them. So, you know, I mean, I look at these guys these puppets that head things is like, well, you know, they are what they are. They're public faces and they make certain pronouncements, but in the end, at the end of the day, I don't think they have all that much power. And I think that the problems are so deeply systemic in the Western world in terms of the economies that nothing's going to change. I mean, nothing outside of a complete revamping of the whole capitalism of the Western world would really change things. You know, it's just the whole game is rigged. You know, anybody who takes the surface noise seriously is an idiot. That's my own perspective on it. You know, I mean, you know,
the only other way I can see it changing is if people around the world were actually able to enforce their own anti-terrorist legislation that allows you to seize the assets of anyone involved in terrorist activity, and then we identify who these terrorists are, including these people who spray us with chemtrails and do all these other deviant things like enforced inoculations
Who controls the court system? That's not going to happen. I mean, it's just not.
I know, Jim. I know, but this is the concept.
No, I mean, no. That's the reality. I mean, on the one hand, the reality is not
fixed, and this has been the reality of what exists now. Yes, is it?
All these monumental powers to these guys. Do you think that these guys are ever going to let you get in a court and argue with these things? I mean, it's absurd. Like, I mean, it's just not going to happen. I mean, the whole system. That's what I say. The system is rigged, and these guys are very good at protecting their own interests. And, you know, I mean, the only way is to call these people to account is in a series of gradual steps, and it's not going to happen. Not going to happen overnight. It's a long, long process. They may have tipped it a little bit too far. That's the only hope I see in all of this, is that they may have tipped it too far. I mean, it's incredibly complex situation and very, very difficult. But
I see. The magnitude of the Gulf issue as a false flag event on the same magnitude as 9/11.
You don't know that. You don't know that.
No.
So you have to say this. You don't know that. It could be. It could not be. You know, I mean, who knows?
Well,
Who knows? I mean, no, who knows?
Well,
I mean,
a lot of people know. A lot of people know who were really involved in that. How can you say nobody knows? Of course some people know.
What if it was an accident? What if it was just what they said? What if the original event was just an accident?
Well, it's a lot more complex than that. Like an accident.
Maybe it isn't. Maybe it isn't. I mean, you're just kind of like, it's the same thing. You're providing a ready-made explanation of something that, like, how do you know that? That's my objection.
To explain all the evidences which support it. That's how.
Well, there's always evidence to support different things. I mean, like, people have been having accidents with drill rigs since they first started drilling. That's the
problem.
So
you believe in accident theory.
Yes. Well, no, I believe accidents happen. I mean, it's completely ludicrous to say that, you know, that everything is a result of some sort of planning. The world's just not run that way, I mean, in any way. Like, I mean, there are earthquakes that just happen, you know. We had an earthquake here the other day in Toronto.
And you believe that just happened. I am noticing we're going over a bit, and I think we may have our guest on in the back. So we'll have time later with Calvin. I'm sure we'll come back to some of these issues, but I should kind of rein us in a little bit here. And is that okay, Jim?
Yep. Can I mention very quickly one thing that going back to what you were talking about at the beginning of the program about the heart doctrine is the Dutch cardiologist Pin van Lommel, who I think you know is a near-death experience researcher who did a long-term study and published a major study in the British Lancet Medical Journal in 2001, has a book out called Consciousness Beyond Life, The Science of Near-Death Experience, and I think you would be very interested in, I just read the introduction to his book, you would be very, very interested in what he says, and some of the questions he asks, I think your model of consciousness very clearly addresses what he raises as essential questions. So I think at some point we have to read this book together and discuss it on the program.
Yeah, I'll watch for that. That's an excellent idea. Yeah, good. Oh, okay, so we're going to shift gears a little bit. And I met this fellow who I'm going to have on in a moment. It's Bob Reinisch from Idaho in the United States, and I met Bob just over the internet when he was in the chat room and under the name Bob for Senate, and I inquired from Bob what he was about, and he directed me to his website, and I understand that he's running as an independent write-in candidate in the state of Idaho. And I looked at his website, and I saw he's an elderly gentleman, older in age, someone who's kind of not been political through their life, but is rising to the challenge of trying to take back and serve his country. So I invited Bob on today's show. Bob, are you there?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon.
Welcome. Thanks for joining us today, Bob. Sorry to hold you, be a little bit late in coming to you. I'd really like for you just to have the floor to introduce yourself and maybe describe what you're attempting to do and how people can help you. And I'll just yield to you, Bob, and give you the time.
Thank you, sir. Well, my name is Bob Reinisch. When I declared my candidacy, they told me I had to go by my full name, so it's Frederick Robert Reinisch, Jr., which makes it even more difficult to get elected. However, I'm an old submarine sailor. I was on the Polaris submarine Henry Clay back in the 60s, and I served my country then, and since then I've also worked at Long Beach Naval Shipyard for 30 years in quality assurance, and I could address your issue of the accident syndrome, but we could save that for another show. In any case, I was sitting in front of my television set one day, and I saw a couple of politicians, typical politicians, a Democrat and a Republican, bickering over petty things and partisan politics. And I had this terrible feeling that came over me. It was a terrible feeling of sadness. And I got to thinking, we have some fine young men and women overseas fighting and dying for our way of life and the freedom to worship as we please. And what are they going to come home to? Well, it bothered me for quite a while, so I prayed about it for about 2.5 days, and I said, I can't sit here and do nothing anymore. I have to do something. So I prayed about it a little bit more, and it came to me that, well, run for office. Because I think the major problem, or the major solution, rather, to the problems that we have in the United States, and probably somewhat in the world, is our Congress. Congress is the driving force behind everything that we have a problem with today. You know, it's kind of funny that they campaign against deficit spending. They campaign against the terrible deficit that we have. They campaign against the illegal alien problem that we have. But they're the ones that caused it. They've made everything happen. If it weren't for Congress, the problems that we have today, us being in Afghanistan, us being in Iran, the economic situation that we have, wouldn't exist if they didn't want it to exist. So that's why I decided to run for Congress.
It's come that Congress doesn't serve the needs of the people anymore. It seems they're controlled by these international or corporate elites and interests rather than serving the American people.
Well, this is true. I think Congress has come to the point where they rule the people rather than serving the people, and that's got to change. We got to start somewhere in order to resolve all of the situations that exist in our United States today. Where is the place to start? The place to start is fire Congress. How do we fire Congress? One seat at a time. The problem is what do we got to choose from? We've got Democrats, we've got Republicans. We say, well, you know, if you've got a Democrat in place, anti-incumbent, vote out the Democrat and put a Republican in place, or vice versa. Well, that's like a cancer surgeon that removes a tumor. Does he install another tumor when he gets done? Of course not.
That's very appropriate. Yeah, it's like the same parties have been controlled by the same forces, even though there are people, I think, they're attempting to work within these parties, too. Like, you see that happening as well. Like, I think some states...
There are genuinely people who are attempting to work within the parties that are patriots, that do love this country and want the best for this country. But those aren't the ones that get elected. You look at my opponent right now. He's been in Congress for 18 years. He promised he'd only run twice in the Senate, but he's up for his third term, so he's either opposed to his own reelection or he's lying to the public. In addition, 84% of his campaign funds came from people like Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, all of the major mortgage corporations, all of the big banks. So is he part of the problem or is he part of the solution? He's got $2.4 million to spend to defeat me.
Yeah, and name and media coverage.
He's getting the media coverage because he's the incumbent, he's got the money to pay for the advertising, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you want to put the responsibility back where it lies, you know, we have people that are screaming for term limits for our congressmen.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Great idea. But we already have term limits in place. Did you know that?
With your elections every 4 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The people of the state of Idaho and the rest of the United States of America have caused this situation, myself included, because we weren't willing to go against the status quo. We weren't willing to. It's like, you know, when you catch somebody cheating at cards, it's time to tip over the table. You don't keep playing.
Yeah. So how long ago did you announce your candidacy, Bob?
Unfortunately, it was just in March of this year, and it was right into the deadline to get on the primary ticket and to get my name on the ballot. So, unfortunately, I wasn't in a position to raise enough names in a timely manner to meet those deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
So that,
but you
hence, I'm a write-in candidate.
A write-in candidate, okay.
I'm a legally declared write-in candidate registered with the Secretary of State of the state of Idaho.
Yeah, excellent. Do you have some organization or help in your campaign?
I have a number of individuals. We do not have an organization.
What's your strategy for trying to promote your aim? And are there other candidates similar write-in candidates in Idaho?
No, from what I understand, there are not. There is a declared Democrat and a declared Republican, and the Republican is the incumbent. The part of the strategy behind my campaign is I realize that for the last presidential election, Obama raised $350 million over the internet, $10 at a time. Well, if he can raise that much money, I can raise enough votes to get elected in Idaho. I plan on doing it over the internet, discussion groups, blogs, concerned citizens that are willing to vote for me to go out and get 10 more votes. Go out and get 10 more people on the internet. Email all our in-laws, all our outlaws. And in addition to that, I'd like to expand the campaign to include the rest of the United States. You know, if we could raise a declared write-in candidate for all 50 states, we could take away the House and one-third of the Senate this election. Now, that would raise some eyebrows and get a few things done.
Yeah,
I'm calling on all the other veterans in the United States. Stand up and be counted. You know, regardless of the outcome, at least those who stand up and are counted can go home after the elections and say, at least I did something. I didn't sit by and watch our country go down the sewer.
Yeah, at least I tried. At least I made an effort. And the very effort and the very attempt to try increases the awareness of what the issues are, like to get people out of this left-right Republic-Democrat paradigm.
One of the biggest problems in that area is the brainwashing that's been done by both the Democrats and the Republicans for years and years and years. The Democrats will tell you, oh, you can't elect an independent. It's impossible. The Republicans will tell you, well, if you vote for an independent, you'll split the vote and give it to the Democrats. And it's all hogwash. The people can vote any way they please, and how they vote will determine the outcome, period. At least this week, until that freedom's taken away from us, too.
Yeah, and one wonders even, is there electronic voting in your state?
No, we still have the punch card.
Nice.
Which means in order to vote for me, they're going to have to not punch one of the senators that are up for on the ballot. They're going to have to not punch a hole in the card and then write in my name and U.S. Senate on the envelope that you put the card in. So, see, right off the bat, they make it even more difficult for the write-in candidate.
Yeah, well, that's understandable to some extent.
Oh, yeah, to some extent.
Yeah. Well, at least the ballots aren't electronic, where you can have these built-in deceptions.
Yep, that's true. And even the people who designed those machines indicated that there is a possibility and the opportunity to hack the machines and rig them.
Is there any attempt to coordinate people in different states who might also be running as write-in candidates? Like, is there any way you can interact among yourselves?
I'm open for suggestions in that direction. That's why I'm getting on as many radio stations as I can to try and get the word out. Hey, let's start a war of independence, meaning individuals that are not party affiliated. Vote Fed, vote independent. You know, that's another issue. I think veterans ought to be in Congress. Why should you have an entity that can declare war that has never experienced anything close to it?
Yeah, because they don't go to war, but they line their fancy pants with a lot of fancy money and power and position.
You betcha. You know, I don't begrudge the congressman
as Smedley Butler says.
I don't begrudge Congress getting their $170 salary. You know, they've got a big responsibility. They've got a lot to do. I don't begrudge them that money. What I do begrudge them is the $2.2 to $4.9 million expense accounts, and that's each.
Wow.
They just canceled their last pay raise because of public opinion. Say, oh, well, you know, because of the economic times, we won't keep our $4,000 pay raise. We'll turn it back. We'll decline it. We'll cancel it. But what they didn't tell the American people is they just voted themselves a $93,000 increase in their expense accounts.
Wow.
And these are the same arrogant people. What's that?
They gorged the public funds.
Absolutely. And these are the same people. There was a reporter recently that reported it's common practice to refer to the airline classes as first class, business class, voter class. That is totally arrogant.
Well, I'm glad they're not saying useless either. Someday they'll have that. They have elite minions
and useless eaters?
Well, I sincerely hope not. And I'm, like I said, I'm doing my part. I'm doing what I can. And if it's God's will and the people's will, I'm going to Washington in January. If not, I'll come home and say, okay, I did what I could.
Yeah, well, that's...
Go ahead.
That's what we need, Bob. I mean, we need, you know, you're not, I feel I'm an elder. I'm over 60, and you know, I never would have become involved in politics. But then to see what's being done, not only to our country, but to our society and to people around the world, it's time for more and more of us to stand forward and make some efforts to oppose the tide of this growing totalitarianism and abuse of the peoples.
I think it's the only salvation we got. If we don't stand up now, this is the key. Congress and the powers to be still realize that at the present time, the voter still has the power to defeat their efforts. Of course, they're also banking on the fact that the voter will not exercise that power. So this November will tell. We've got the best opportunity right now to elect independents that we've ever had in the history of this country.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
whether the people exercise that or not, November will tell.
Yeah. I'm going to just invite Jim, my co-host, here, Bob, if he has any comments. Jim?
Hi.
Yeah, I didn't know if you had anything you wanted to ask Bob or share.
Well, one thing I totally agree with him about veterans is that I noticed that the enthusiasm for going to war seems to be inversely correlated with the individual's participation in a war. It always seems that the people who are most gung-ho and most ready to fight are the ones who've never actually been in a war, never actually served in the military. So, I think that's a very important point,
I totally agree. That's one issue that my opponent and I share in common. We're both draft dodgers.
Oh, well, better yet.
I ran off and joined the Navy and served on a submarine to stay out of the Army. He ran off, went to college, and became a lawyer to stay out of the Army.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So if you were elected, what would be the first priority that you would have if you did in fact go to Washington? What would your number one priority be?
Well, first of all, I'm not naive enough to think that if I am the only independent elected that I can get much done, because
right.
I won't be able to get much done. That's a
yeah.
fact. I know that, and I'm not naive enough to think otherwise.
Yeah.
Actually, I already decided three of the first things I would do when I get to Washington. Number one would be take the door off my office, because I will have a literal open door policy. The second thing I will do is take a folding chair to the first meeting of Congress, because I will sit in the aisle. I will not sit on the left or the right. The third thing I will do is, God forbid, if we lose any more of our fine young men and women overseas, I will personally play taps on the Capitol Dome steps at sundown every evening that we lose one of our fine people. Over and above that, I will vote against any increase in the size of government. Any increase in government spending, period. I will vote against any bill that has a rider on it. If it can't stand on its own, it doesn't deserve to be passed. The rest I'll have to play by ear, because I've never been there before.
Okay, so excellent. And is there, Bob, can you give out firstly your website and then your email address if people want to contact you? And I think it would be good to, if there was some correspondence among people in a similar position in other states, that you might, try at least to be aware of each other and see if you share some other policy interests and concerns.
Absolutely, my friend. I'm glad you asked. The website is www.reinisch4senate.com.
Reinisch4senate.com.
Okay, .com.
And I guess there's an email address there. or do you want to give
that? I can be accessed, or I can be contacted right on the website, but I'll also give you my email address.
Okay.
It's www.breinisch@ccifi.org.
Okay, except without the www, though, I'm sure. You said www.
Oh, yes, you're right. I'm sorry.
You wouldn't have that. Yeah, yeah.
You're absolutely right. Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah. Okay, well, I wish you the best. And you, how many months do you have here? July, August, September, October, November. So almost 5 months still to be organizing and promoting your concept. And I think, as you say, like, the internet is what's available to us. And what could be done, and spreading your I hope you're contacting other groups in your state who have
absolutely
related concerns, like whether it be anti-war or health freedoms or, yeah, you're doing that. Where are you based out of? What major city
Idaho
are
Falls.
You?
Idaho Falls. I'm in Idaho Falls, Idaho. That's the southeastern portion of Idaho.
Yeah, great. Okay, and any final things you'd like to add or comment on, Bob?
It's up to the people. Vote vet, vote independent. The party's
yes.
over, both Democrats and Republicans.
And we need patriots, we need Americans to stand forward again. It's like our countries are in great need at this time, and the Constitution of the United States is in great peril. I mean, it's already
absolutely.
Been degraded and abused endlessly over the past years.
Absolutely.
It's so shameful, you know, that these bills go through Congress, often hundreds of pages long, with all kinds of additional addendums and clauses and such, all hidden, and these things actually pass through the Senate, where senators don't even have time to read it.
Well, they don't have time to read it. They don't have time to serve as in the Congress.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, bless you, Bob, for standing forward and rising to the occasion and being willing to serve your country again.
Thank you, my friend, and do me a favor.
Yeah.
Have a blessed day.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Goodbye. Well, that's an interesting interview, Jim, and concept. If there were the rise of these kind of independent write-in candidates, it's like so much of everything is stacked against them in terms of money in the mainstream media, but at least there's that internet possibility, and there's growing awareness. People are seeking alternatives.
Yeah, well... Pretty uphill fight, though. I mean, it's no matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican, the chances, if you're an incumbent, of getting defeated are almost non-existent. Like, it's so stacked against the challengers. You know, that's part of, like, the whole idea behind term limits, is that it's so hard to unseat an incumbent, eh? Like, because they just have so much more in terms of resources.
Yeah, and media sympathy and coverage and so on.
It's not even that. It's just like, you know, they can buy time in the media to advertise, and they can certainly influence, like they talk about controlling the narrative. It's very hard to, if you're an independent challenger, to get your message out there. But the more radical things that you say, of course, the more marginalized you become, too. One place where the internet is a truly, is an equalizer, because you can bypass that, and you can network. So, I mean, that provides a very powerful tool that just didn't exist for people before. Sort of a guerrilla campaign can be run on the internet. So that's definitely,
I mean, it's due.
A change very radically. And I mean, even in Obama's case, they raised a ton of money. You know, I mean, traditionally the Republicans have had way more money than the Democrats. They raised a ton of money on the internet, small donations.
Yeah, and Ron Paul did the same.
Yeah.
I think he on the internet raised more in one day than had ever been done in running for the primaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean,
yeah. Well, I think also, but I mean, I think the very fact of I don't know. I think in a way we have to oppose what's happening in all these different arenas. Like, you know, it's such a complicated systemic problem that we've come to here. And in a way we have to fight them on all these different issues and on different grounds. It's like Churchill says, you know, we'll fight them in the air, we'll fight them on the land, we'll fight them at sea. You know, it's like that. It's like we as citizens, we have to kind of rise up and object to all these different things being done to us. You know, wanting to maintain our freedoms and not wanting our countries brought into one world government under, you know, some kind of fascist rule, you know. People want to live freely and don't want to be socially engineered in this way. You know, we want to know the truth about things and we're tired of the endless wars and tired of having being sprayed by chemtrails, which is, brings us to our next guest maybe I'll move forward here a little bit because I'm hoping Calvin's available in the background. Are you there, Calvin? Okay, Jim, so our friend isn't available at this point. He's Calvin Keats, and Calvin worked in the Canadian Action Party for a while and was president of it, but then he's more recently become involved in a group trying to develop an international conference on chemtrails. Which they're hoping to do over through over the internet, and they're arranging it for the fall, and it involves one of the main researchers in this area, Con Nakam, who's studied chemtrails and related issues for 15 to 20 years. So they're developing this international conference. So if we can't get through to Calvin today, I'll have him back on a later show. So we'll move along. So we may have Calvin. Seth in the studio there is still trying to get hold of him, and hopefully that'll work out. I also want to bring up, Jim, I didn't know, did you see the pictures I put up on my website of these strange objects I've been spotting in the sky? Isn't that weird? To describe these a bit to the listener, one evening just from the back steps of my home, I noticed this seemingly larger, bright star. It looked almost like a star, but it didn't seem so far away, and it was kind of suspended in the sky over a particular area. And it seemed to be bigger than the star and earlier than the star, so I was puzzled by what it could be. And then it also didn't seem to be moving. So I realized, I observed it long enough, I realized that it was stationary there. And I have simply a 12-zoom Fuji camera and took some digital photos of it. Because by my eye, I couldn't really discern structure to it. But when I zoomed in on my camera and took some pictures and enlarged them on the computer, I found that this thing seems to be one of these like worm-like UFOs, meaning unidentified flying object. Like it's because it is unidentified and it didn't seem to be flying. It's stationary in space and it's some kind of object or being or something. And these are very unusual. They're like worms almost. They don't have a fixed structure, but they kind of move in space. And if I take photographs of this in series, each time its orientation and what it presents to me is slightly different. So I put some pictures of this up on my website, which is at www.zeropoint.ca. And just inviting to any comments on them or other people citing similar things. And I went on the internet because I wasn't familiar with these kinds of objects, and I found some videos produced out of Mexico, three or four of them, by the same people, I think. And they showed objects that looked exactly like the kinds of things that I've been seeing, which are almost like little sections of strings or worms. I think sometimes they're called serpents, but they seem to kind of move in space. Yeah, all very peculiar. So I put some links on my page. I only have a camera, and it wouldn't be worthwhile me trying to take a video of it because I don't think I can enlarge it then. I'd need specialized equipment to do that. So anyway, there are some good links which depict these kind of worm-like objects. And what's so peculiar for me is that over a period of 2 to 3 weeks, it was appearing almost every day where the skies were clear, where I could have seen it. Because if it's overcast, I couldn't even perceive it. So, and it also seemed to kind of be in almost the same position of the sky, and often around the same time, which is between 9 and 11 in the evenings. And that was consistent, and then it would be gone, and I wouldn't see it further through that evening. So anyway, I put these pictures up there, and I'm really quite puzzled by what these things are. Jim, were you familiar at all when you saw those pictures? Had you ever seen those kinds of things supposedly flying around in our sky or in our skies?
No, I've never seen anything like that. That's very weird.
Did you watch a video at the bottom? I linked to three YouTube videos where they actually have video of it, whereas mine are just snapshots.
No, I've just seen the shots, no.
Yeah, the videos show what they're like, you know, much better than do my photographs. I'm totally puzzled by it, and it didn't seem to me like, how can this be an aliens? Like, aliens, I don't think, would come kind of to the same place at the same time of day and, like, have that kind of routine or consistency. It's all most peculiar to me. I really have no idea what to make of it.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it for a few days now, but it's been overcast, and that just obstructs my vision. Yeah, that's very peculiar. So anyway, watch those videos sometimes. The YouTube links are given on my site, and I don't know where further to go with it, really. I have a friend, and I'm trying to arrange someone who might have a better camera or video with a greater amplification. It would be nice to try to get some videos of it. But in the meantime, it's just another strange thing going on in our environment. So, our guests haven't shown up here, Jim, so it's kind of open. Anything you'd like to get back to or anything you'd like to discuss?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'd just like to read. I'm really quite interested in this book by Pim van Lommel, the Dutch cardiologist that I mentioned before. As I said, I just read the introduction of the book, so I'm getting a rough idea of what he's arguing or what his approach to it is, but I'm really encouraged by reading it because, first of all, he's done a long-term study of these experiences. He describes at the beginning how when he was a young doctor, he had resuscitated somebody who had cardiac arrest and how he was a very skeptical attitude towards the near-death experience, and wasn't until years later that he really began to be interested in the phenomena. But just from the jacket, it says that this book apparently has just been translated into English. It's sold 125,000 copies in Europe, which is pretty amazing for a nonfiction book about, you know, anything. It says, Van Lommel provides scientific evidence that the near-death phenomenon is an authentic experience that cannot be attributed to imagination, psychosis, or oxygen deprivation, which are the traditional explanations from skeptical inquirers and materialists. He further reveals that after such a profound experience,
most patients' personalities undergo a permanent change. In Van Lommel's opinion, the current views on the relationship between the brain and consciousness held by most physicians, philosophers, and psychologists are too narrow for a proper understanding of the phenomenon. In Consciousness Beyond Life, Van Lommel shows that our consciousness does not always coincide with brain functions, and that remarkably and significantly, consciousness can even be experienced separate from the body. And he says in the first chapter, he's talking about, he says, our consciousness transmits information to the brain and via the brain receives information from the body and the senses. The function of the brain can be compared to a transceiver. Our brain has a facilitating rather than a producing role. It enables the experience of consciousness. There's also increasing evidence that consciousness has a direct effect on the function and the anatomy of the brain and the body, with DNA likely to play an important role. So he's really rejecting the whole materialist paradigm that and the dominant epistemological assumption in Western science is that consciousness produces consciousness. The material processes, the electrochemical processes of the brain produce consciousness. He says that his research clearly challenges and provides such strong anomalous evidence that obviously there's something wrong with that explanation, that consciousness very clearly can exist apart from the body. Like he talks about people being conscious when there is no heart activity, when there's no blood flow to the brain. So somehow they're still conscious. How can that be explained? It can't be explained within the current paradigm. And yet, in terms of your model, there's a very interesting explanation of what's going on in terms of these experiences, which I think is quite different from anything else I've read.
Yeah. Well, firstly, in its emphasis on the heart as the, but there again, I'm not even saying that it's the human heart produces consciousness.
Right.
I'm just saying that somehow this multidimensional or higher dimensional self or entity within us acts through the heart, that the heart is the focus point in a way for its consciousness and life to emerge into the living human being. And it's amazing how in a fetus it's like the heart that becomes defined the first, and then the heartbeat begins, and it's like life emerges from the heart in the growing fetus. The self isn't within the heart, really. It's more that the self is within the higher dimensional spaces which underlie the dynamics of the human heart. So that's very interesting. Yeah, he sees that the idea that the brain produces consciousness is false, and that consciousness is not simply these mental processes we have going on within our head, that there's something much more fundamental and unknown about its origin.
Yeah, and I see, you know, I think this is one area where this whole phenomenon, which is a relatively recent phenomenon in terms of I think its frequency is greater because there's been such advances in cardiac resuscitation technology in the last 40 years. Raymond Moody's book came out in the mid-70s, Life After Life, which was kind of the groundbreaking book. And since then, there's been all of these, there's been several very good studies and books written about it. Various people like Kenneth Rings, a psychologist, Michael Sabam, who's a cardiologist, Van Lommel, who's a cardiologist, various other writers who have reviewed the evidence. And it's interesting. It seems to me that most of these people start out as skeptics. My Moody himself was completely skeptical, and yet it's kind of a parallel to what we've talked about many times on this program. It's that they've come to the realization that they have to unlearn, that they have to drop what they've been taught as physicians and scientists that consciousness is produced in the brain, and they have to look anew because the evidence is so overwhelmingly contradictory. It reminds me kind of also of the, you know, what happened in physics in the early part of the 20th century when the quantum reality became so bizarre that people realized, well, somehow, at some level, all of the Newtonian mechanical ideas break down, and that you have to think in completely different ways about things, and that the evidence is so overwhelming that you can't ignore it, you can't subsume it to some sort of
existing explanation. So you need what Thomas Kuhn calls a paradigm shift. Like, you have to have a radical reconfiguration of your assumptions, your theoretical explanations, the whole gestalt in which you are going to organize information and your explanations of it. And I think this has happened largely. I think that this whole phenomena, because it's accessible scientifically in terms of it happens to people in hospitals, and you can get good data on it. It's not anecdotal data. You can actually interview these people, and you can find out what they say, and you have the sample of them. Like, there's this huge sample. It keeps growing. And the fact that they consistently report the same types of things, just, you know, you can't ignore it. You can't just say, oh, well, it's anomalous and leave it at that. It begs for some sort of different explanation. And here's a guy who's a cardiologist who takes that challenge seriously. It's very encouraging to read somebody like this. And I think there are more and more people. There's still, you know, a very small minority, but neurologists and psychologists and physicians who are realizing that this whole approach to the explanation of consciousness is wrong in terms of the conventional thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's of such profound significance because it suggests that we are not simply these bodies. We are not simply physical material organisms that live and die with the body. Instead, there is a way in which consciousness and self-existence can be maintained apart from the physical body, which has such profound implications. It suggests a possibility for life after death. It suggests a possibility that we might perceive or experience within these other dimensions. I mean, I know it was like 30 years ago when I began studying the near-death experience literature, and I remember Michael Sabon, that cardiologist you mentioned.
Yep.
I was very impressed with his study called Recollections of Death, because here again was a skeptical person who didn't believe it and was trying to disprove it. So he took relatively small samples of, I think he had about 25 people who claimed to have had out-of-body experiences during cardiac emergencies and claimed to have witnessed some of the events going on in the operating room or in surrounding areas. And he compared them with a kind of a matched control group of 25 people who had cardiac emergencies but made no such claims, that they really lost consciousness completely and really didn't know what was done to resuscitate them and so on. And so he had all these people describe what was done when they were in this emergency. And it's like every one of those subjects who didn't experience being out of their body but attempted to describe what they would have seen, like based upon their expectation, their knowledge of these things, every one of them made some fundamental kind of mistake in what they described. Whereas among those people who did claim to be out of their bodies and witness these events, none of them made any major error in their descriptions. So it was like overwhelmingly kind of clear, even with an N of 25 to 30 subjects, that all the statistics came out like clearly in favor of the fact supporting their claims that they had witnessed these events, for which is no known explanation. And all of which suggests that consciousness can exist apart from the body. And then you start putting it together with all other kinds of evidences for out-of-body experiences or psychical experiences of different kinds. So it's or studies of ghosts, a study of possession. Like, it's like when you begin to see all the different evidences from different areas, that in a way it all supports each other. Like the fact that people have moments of ESP or synchronous events and other psychical phenomena, in a way it's all consistent with there being the possibility for near-death experiences. It all supports each other in suggesting the basic thesis that we are not simply this body, but there's something more subtle as regards to the origins of human consciousness, that somehow it can be sustained and experienced within other dimensions, such that it's not dependent on the material form. And that's a basic concept in all these different mystical spiritual teachings, that there's some higher dimensional self or divine spark or spiritual spark or jiva atma or monad. There's something that in a sense inhabits the material body but is not dependent on it. And I know how Swami Prabhupada, he says, it's like it puts on a pair of clothes. And he says how scientists, well, if they study the person's clothes, thinking that clothes were the real man or individual, what a mistake that would be. And he says, similarly, we kind of put on the material form, but that material form is not what we are in our essential self or essential I nature. So, So I think that's what led me, like, it was those kinds of evidences 30 years ago to, you know, I got to the point after having my own experiences, and I know you had out-of-body experiences which seemed evidentially real to you, and, you know, it was the accumulation of all that kind of data that 30 years ago led me to not want to try to prove that these phenomena occur, but instead to try to develop an understanding of how could this be possible? Like, what could be the possible physics and metaphysics of what this entails? Because in my view, there has to be a physics and metaphysics to it. Like, if people claim in afterlife states that they go into different realms and encounter spiritual beings, or they encounter relatives who have passed over and things like this, well, these dimensions have to have a physics to them. You know, it's a physics beyond our physics, in a sense, so you might call it a metaphysics. But by the very definition, what are the physics and metaphysics of these worlds? How could it possibly work? And that kind of led to, you know, deeper and deeper studies, which led to the zero-point hypothesis and this idea of how there's a holographic physics to the human heart. I think that's one of the most profound ideas, and I think what was most helpful to me was reading that experience of Yogananda's cosmic consciousness many years ago, where he kind of experienced his consciousness leaving his body and expanding states of samadhi, in which he kind of blended with his old environment and then the solar system and then eventually like the galaxy and the universe. He experienced his consciousness expanding into those levels of the cosmic structure. And then in the very end of his experience, all of a sudden he's like whoosh and he's brought back into his body, and he makes a statement that he cognized a point of intuitive perception within his own heart, which radiated splendor. Goodness, I can't exactly remember his wording.
That's pretty close.
Yeah, irradiating splendor issued to the entire universal structure, something along that line.
Yeah. That's pretty good, actually. That's the gist of what he says, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like the Upanishads. One of the Upanishads of ancient India says, the sun, the moon, the earth, all things that are within the outer world are within the cave of Brahman, or meaning the lotus of the heart. So what the mystics suggest, there is some type of higher dimensional holographic physics to the human heart. And that's such a profound idea. And when we both read those quotes from Yogananda, it was at a time when the holographic paradigm was emerging in psychology. So it made that concept, like Yogananda's experience is a perfect depiction of the holographic paradigm and model of human consciousness. That somehow there, within the human heart, there is this kind of interconnectedness to the larger universe and its subtle dimensions.
Yeah, I like there's a quote, I think it's from that you quote in your book from the Chandra Upanishad, which says essentially that as vast as the universe is outside us, the universe within us is equally as vast, or something to that effect. And I mean, when you begin to explore this, you realize that this is true, that there, that it's totally counterintuitive, and yet, as you say, it's entirely consistent when you begin to have an understanding of holographic principles, that somehow all of the whole could be contained within the parts, and that really our Cartesian notion of time and space is illusory on some essential level, some higher level. All of this collapses, and so that you can have experiences as are described in modern physics of non-locality, where things can be in communication, which are faster than the speed of light, which should be impossible, but has been, you know, demonstrated experimentally to be true. I want to say too that you made a very interesting point just about these experiences and how you came to the point of view of trying to explain them rather than trying to determine the reality. And I think for me, one of the things that really has struck me over the years too, above and beyond just the experience of people having an experience of consciousness apart from the body, that in and of itself is such an amazing anomaly. And when you start to add up all the anecdotal evidence of this happening, you realize that this is something that has to be explained. But there's another part to it in the near-death experience, which is so interesting, which Van Lommel, it clearly addresses in his book. He talks about it in the introduction. And it's that's the transformation in people that have these experiences when they come back and they continue with their lives. They are transformed in terms of their attitudes towards death, in terms of their attitudes towards life, in terms of their attitude towards whether or not life and the universe have meaning. And then people have very dramatic transformations frequently in their attitudes to these essential questions. And this is entirely consistent with what Aldous Huxley talked about in a speech that he made in the 1960s when he talked about light and the visionary experience. And he was talking about people who have had experienced transcendent experiences of consciousness, some of them spontaneously, some of them higher kind of mystical experiences, some of them lower kind of mystical experiences, but that repeatedly people talk about the transformation and their understanding of themselves, and they lose their fear of death. They have a feeling of the essential all-rightness of the universe. They say that they can't translate these experiences that they've had into the ordinary language with which we normally communicate, but that they are very certain. It's not a hunch. It's not an impression. They know that these are higher realities that they've experienced, and that's another aspect of this experience of being out of your body. I mean, most people know about the idea that when people have near-death experiences, they go down this tunnel, and they emerge into this light. And often there are descriptions of meeting dead relatives and loved ones and pets and people and beings that they've had contact with it in their previous life who have passed away. And often there's an experience where people encounter like this higher type of light, which is an intelligence and which communicates to them very reassuring ideas and feelings and which leads them to have these transformative experiences. But there's also, in some cases, this is really amazing, is that, well, people have life reviews too, of course, when they see their entire, standard idea about, you know, I saw my entire life flash before me. And, that's to be understood literally. Like people in what we would call seconds see their entire life pass before them. But in some cases too, people not only see their entire lives pass before them, but they also understand, they have an understanding of what the impact of their life has had on other people, which I find a very fascinating aspect of this experience. But all of these things that have come out of the study of the near-death experience are entirely consistent with what mystics and visionaries have expressed and have tried to describe for thousands and thousands of years, and which are always involve states of consciousness in which there's some sort of transcendence of time and space and all of the normal parameters of how we exist in our bodies in four-dimensional time space. So there's this transcendent element, and the aspects of the transcendent element are remarkably congruent across the thousands of years and are more remarkably congruent with what's now being discovered in terms of the study of near-death experiences.
Yeah, and it seems that also like there's varied things that people experience, and yet it's not inconsistent with each other. It's like different people are drawn into different realms. Like it's been interesting, like there's been some literature also of people being drawn into hellish type worlds.
Yeah.
Which also has a transformative effect on them afterwards. My God, what have I been doing? You know,
yeah.
and kind of horrifying visions, and other people kind of meeting relatives versus other people who kind of go down the tunnel. Like not everybody goes down the tunnel, and not everybody has a life review. Like different people, these different elements pop up.
Yeah.
And not every, it's those people who pass down the tunnel into a realm of light, like they're consistently described as like entering a spiritual world and encountering spiritual beings, which kind of have this unconditioned love and acceptance of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. It always brings me back to that quotation by Uspensky, who kind of said, if we could gather up all these, what he calls system-destroying facts, like all these evidences that raise questions about what we are as human beings and how consciousness can exist apart from the body, and human beings do have latent psychical and mystical faculties. Like if you gather up all those evidences, Uspensky says, it would wash away everything that we think we know. And it's like so much is advanced in material science, but on another level, when it comes to understanding the kind of origin of human consciousness, it's like we've made no progress. And when we awaken to that fact, it's bound to bring a new paradigm and transformation in different areas of science, because I think it brings a whole new way of trying to understand, well, you know, if we're not the physical bodies, then what is human evolution? And the mystics describe human evolution in a different way, as acquiring our spiritual bodies, like these higher being bodies which underlying the physical, and acquiring different capacities as we attain these bodies. Like Gurdjieff describes, attaining your spiritual body, which he says then makes you immortal within the limits of the solar system. And that's Gurdjieff's concept. So the idea that, wow, you would actually then likely have different lives or exist in different realms within the solar system. And that's just one example. But the idea is that we can attain to different bodies, and there's a whole teaching in theosophy and other teachings about how, you know, we have the physical body, then the astral body, then the mental body, and then the fourth is described as the causal body, which is like the eye, which is the illumination that illuminates so you can be aware through your mental, astral, and physical bodies. But the bodies are not consciousness. Somehow consciousness has this higher dimensional origin, and in a way its illumination is stepped down and obscured more and more as we come into the physical. That in our lives we, through death or through mystical experiences, kind of awaken to these deeper levels of our own nature. It's such a profound mystery play life is, and it's amazing how all the mystics describe like the importance of understanding the mysteries of the human heart. You know, you see that in everything from Gibran to the Bhagavad Gita to the Dalai Lama. All these mystical teachings are trying to point to, they all point to this kind of mystical dimensions to the human heart. And this isn't to say that these ideas aren't scientific. Like it's not that they're mystical and they're not scientific. It's that we have to extend science to try to understand how these things operate. And there's a science, there's a higher science to understanding these things in terms of understanding what human beings really are and what our origins are.
Well, as you say, too, it's interesting because the development of science over the last 300 years has been really extraordinary, and we know more and more about the material world, and we're able to act on it in more and more complex and amazing ways, some of which are bad, some of which are good. It's sort of lost that in assuming this materialist position, which has become sort of the dominant viewpoint in science, that we've also lost a great deal, and we've banished all ideas about spirit and soul and any kind of animism or consciousness in the cosmos, and it's regarded as we're part of a big machine and which is the cosmos. But the irony is that in 20th century physics that really that idea has been revealed to be unsustainable, and as Sir James Jean said in the 1930s, something to the effect that the whole thrust of modern physics was to the arrival of the realization of a non-mechanical nature of reality, which begged to be explained. And Eddington in the same period said that physics had brought us to a point where we realize that the material world that we observe is a shadow world, and that there's something beyond that which physics can't penetrate, but still begs to be explained, and that perhaps mysticism was the approach which would lead us to an explanation of this ultimate level of reality. And yet most of this is kind of overlooked in these ideas have been overlooked in many of modern scientists' proclamations about the nature of reality and the nature, whether or not God exists. I mean, you never see this in any of these explanations. And yet, within science, there's this persistent questioning of the objectivity and the ultimate comprehensiveness of scientific explanations in terms of material processes. But there's also, at the same time, there's this huge body of what you described, Uspensky described as a system-destroying facts. And if you added them all up, you'd realize that we really have such an incomplete knowledge of things. And in a sense, it's like Carl Sagan said many years ago that it seems that the more and more we know there's less and less there is for God to do. But, I mean, you could actually turn that on your head and say that the more and more we know, the less and less we know, and perhaps there's more and more for God to do. Like, there's more and more for a need for non-material explanations of the nature of reality. I want to just quote something which, again, raises what I think is a central issue, which is totally ignored in modern science, and from Van Lommel's book, and he's talking about the transitory nature of the physical body. He says that throughout life, 500,000 cells in the body die every second, 30 million every minute, and 50 billion every day. So in the time that it takes me to say that 500,000 cells in the body die every second, 2,500,000 cells have died in my body in the time it took me to say that, like in 5 seconds. And he says these cells are all replaced again on a daily basis, giving a person an almost entirely new body every couple of years. But he says, he says cells are building blocks, and he says, but what explains the construction and coordination of the ever-changing body from 1 second to the next? And this is, there are two central unsolved questions in modern biology. One is, what is the nature of life? How is it that life arises from supposedly non-sentient matter? And the other is, in terms of human beings, is like, what explains the continuity of the physical body? Like, it's not in the actual physical constituents. There has to be something beyond the physical constituents to explain that continuity and that coherence of the body. These are profound mysteries, and there's nothing really in our explanations, our current explanations, that really address these essential questions. It's just like in psychology, there's no real explanation of the nature of consciousness, which is the most fundamental question in psychology. What is the nature of human consciousness? There's no answer to it. And yet, from a mystical perspective, there is an alternative explanation, which is actually much more sophisticated and comprehensive.
Yeah, and it's exactly like a science has gotten further and further, they come up against all these enigmas, which are consistent what would be with what's been suggested by mystical literature. Like scientists now, they trace the universe back to a singularity, which they say emerges out of the quantum vacuum. Well, that basic concept of things emerging out of nothingness, which is a void plenum, kind of it's a nothingness that somehow contains the fullness of things within itself, that idea has emerged in modern physics, which confirms, in a way, what mystics have said in the Hindu and Kabbalistic and Christian and other traditions for hundreds or thousands of years, is this idea of emergence out of nothingness from point sources. So it's an ancient mystical concept. And the further science advanced, they came to affirm what the mystics have said for this long period of time. And when it comes to the mysteries of the human heart, there are these enigmas of the human heart which scientists have never been able to account for, namely the generation of the heartbeat. And there, it's like they have, you know, scientists come to a blank wall, and it's completely consistent with what the mystics have said, because they're saying that really the heart is like a portal that connects the lower dimensional space to the higher dimensional space. So the heart is this kind of special places where this higher dimensional metaphysics occurs, you know, and then, as you explain, it's like scientists come to this blank wall. They can't explain what life is. Whereas from a mystical point of view, is Prabhupada says life comes from above. Like there's a living entity within the material body. So we'll never see life produced by the material body. It's that the life principle inhabits the material body. And then the other example you're using is like there has to be some underlying fields underlying the material realm that help to organize those bodies. Like they can't explain how when the fetus is growing, how different cells within the body know how to differentiate to become, you know, neurons or kidney cells or what their specialized function is. There's no evident place, there's no evident central control from which that directs that differentiation. Whereas in Blavatsky kind of says that the astral body forms before the physical body. And if you imagined having a magnet under a piece of paper, and you sprinkle iron filings on top of the paper, and they kind of take form as dictated by this underlying magnetic field. Well, Blavatsky's saying the same type of thing occurs within the material body, that there are these underlying electromagnetic centers and fields which then serve to organize and guide the processes that unfold on the material level. So it's at all these levels, it's in all these places where as science advances more and more, they come to blank walls, but that's exactly the point at which a kind of mystical perspective is relevant and is addressing these enigmas. Like the enigmas of zero point origins, the enigma of the human heart, the enigma of what consciousness is, the enigma of all these evidences for multidimensional existence. You know, and you put all those together and you realize we need a new paradigm of understanding.
Yeah.
And that's supported from people from all different, you know, the fellow you're mentioning, he's a cardiologist, is he?
Yes.
You were saying, yeah. Yeah, you see it, doctors, cardiologists, neuropsychologists, you know, different people. They come to those, like, whereas Sagan says, as science advances, there's less and less for God to do. In a way, as science advances, we come to a series of enigmas that are unexplainable without postulating higher dimensional metaphysical forces. That's what I'd say. The science, in a way, is coming to confirm, well, to at least provide a possible basis for understanding what the mystics have claimed to know through direct experience. Like the newest physics, all about the nature of the quantum vacuum and zero-point fields and seven-dimensional hyperspace underlying material space, quantum and connectedness and non-locality. All of these things are supporting basic mystical concepts, that there are these underlying realms, and in the way the phenomena of life are an illusory manifestation of these underlying dimensions and dynamics.
Yeah, and you know, the idea that you try to explain material manifestations in terms of these concepts of higher dimensions and explanations that go beyond materialism is really quite consistent with what's happened in science. Like Theodore Rozak said, you know, in the 19th century, when physicists developed the concept of the field, like the field, he said, is a concept that is as spectral as anything ever that produced by the theological imagination. You know, the field isn't anything. It's an abstraction to explain manifestations in the physical world. And he said, you know, the scientists sort of imbue it with this status as a material concept, but it's not really, like, in a way, it's very much an abstraction. And the same can be said for a lot of things when you talk about the heart doctrine and the zero points. I mean, these are abstractions that are trying to explain phenomena, but if they're internally consistent and coherent, then they have explanatory power and they have to be investigated. And it was very interesting. I was struck by something I read last night by Dr. Ravi Ravindra, who was talking about science and the sacred. And he's a physicist who has explored esoteric teachings for many years and studied the Gurdjieff teaching, is very familiar with various esoteric teachings in nature of yoga and the ancient Hindu texts, and provides very interesting commentaries on things. And he says that, you know, it's interesting, he said that in a couple of hundred years or a couple of thousand years for sure, scientific concepts will have changed dramatically. There'll be very different levels and very different conceptual schemes to explain things and levels of explanation. But he said mystics and esotericists have been saying the same thing for 6,000 years. Like, you know, that's the amazing thing about the heart doctrine, eh? It's like thousands and thousands and thousands of years old, and people keep repeating it. It's not because they've been told it, but they keep sort of rediscovering it and reasserting it because it's a congruent explanation with higher dimensional experiences people have when they develop and transform their consciousness and being. And so what's more objective? Is it the ancient esoteric science or is it modern science? I mean, in a way, like, I think these are what the esotericists are teaching about the nature of consciousness. These are fundamental objective truths and realities that they've discovered, and that they're not going to be overturned by developments in science. And yet, modern science is coming more and more to perspectives of which are, like, at least, at the very least, consistent with, and in some ways provide really interesting elaborations and more comprehensive explanations of things that have been taught by esotericists. So it's a very interesting confluence of these two approaches to the study of so-called objective reality.
Yeah, it does, and it's, to me, the most significant idea is, like, Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine says, material points without extension, meaning like a point that's so it has no extension, so it doesn't appear from to be material with our eyes. It's beyond material points without extension, that they're so small. And she says these are the basis by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. So what this suggests is that living beings, and this is living beings on different orders of scale, whether a human being or a solar system or a universe or a galaxy, the living beings on different orders of scale have these zero-point centers and dynamics. And to apply that concept to human beings, that somehow there's a whole higher dimensional zero-point physics to the human heart. And it's not only to the human heart, because all even in mystical teachings, from the heart center, these forces are said to spread out from 1 0-point center to 7 0-point centers. And we can imagine the system of chakras described by yogis for centuries have this system of 7 chakras, and each of which has a 0-point center. So there's a whole complex, the mystics' ideas, they're even complex in their articulation. Like there's a complex model here, how you go from the heart center, this, you know, you have 3 channels and interconnect 7 chakra points, and there's kind of a 0-point metaphysics to each of these centers. You know, it's a whole basis upon which we can have an understanding of higher states of consciousness and multidimensional existence. And it's really inspiring. And yet the study or exploration of these possibilities has been neglected or suppressed or whatever for over a decade. And now as science has advanced more and more, we're coming back to a point where we can understand these possibilities, I think, in a wholly different way in terms of modern physics. You know, it's amazing. The universe, the physicists trace the universe back to a point 10 to the minus 33 centimeters in diameter. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. So to suggest that a human being might have this kind of 0-point center, well, that's not so inconceivable. It's more inconceivable that the universe might have emerged from a singularity point. That's more unbelievable, I would think, than the idea that a human being might have such a 0-point center. And Blavatsky's suggesting all living beings have such 0-point centers. She describes even our sun as, she describes there being the invisible sun, which is behind our sun. And in a way, our sun is just a portal into a higher dimensional world. But the sun has a 0-point center because it's enlivened by forces from higher dimensions even beyond the sun, which emerge through the sun. So the sun is a living being with a 0-point center, just like a human being. So it's an amazing concept, and it doesn't prove that it's true. We don't know if these things are true or false, but it's an intriguing way of trying to understand both ourselves and other mysteries in science and cosmology and questions about human origins. So, and it's quite inspired to imagine ourselves as having this higher dimensional nature and there being a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. And I think this in a way adds credence to claims made in different religious traditions about the spiritual nature of humankind. And that different religions have different terms and understanding of these concepts. But that happens also in different areas of physics and science. You have different theories and different understanding of different phenomena. So we have that also in religion. But generally, religions agree about the multidimensional nature of existence. They agree in the idea that human beings are somehow ensouled through higher spiritual or divine influences. And mystical and religious teachings all suggest that human existence is multidimensional, and that we can persist beyond death in other realms of existence. And this is a profound extension of what it means to be human, and what are the possibilities for us both in life and then in afterlife. So I know, Jim, we're coming down. We've just got a few minutes here left. I don't know if anything you'd like to pick up on there.
Well, I was just sort of struck when you were talking about the 0-point origins of a human being and then comparing that to the 0-point origins of the universe, you know, and I was struck by, again, we tend to take for granted so much that we have explained things because we can describe them. And I was thinking, like, well, what happens when a human being is conceived? And you know, everybody, we know that, that a sperm cell fertilizes an ovum and that as a result of that, the person starts, you know. But really, we have two physical entities which interact, and out of that, these are supposedly both non-sentient, just material forms that interact. But out of that, a human being arises. Now, when you really start to think about that, like life and consciousness are going to be produced through this, you know, people talk about the miracle of life, but they don't really mean it that it's miraculous. But it is in terms of a solely material explanation. It is a miracle. Because it's like that cartoon, you know, and then a miracle occurs when they're explaining, you know, the origin of the universe. Like they have all their big equation, and then a miracle occurs, and then equals, you know, the universe. Well, it's kind of the same thing with us as human beings. It's like, okay, an egg is fertilized, but how does a human being arise out of that? And when you really, if you're really humble about it and you're really honest about it, you realize we can't really explain that. We can describe it. We have very good, very sophisticated explanations of it or descriptions of it, but those, I would say, I would maintain those aren't explanations of how life arises. It's like, you know, the Bernard Hayshu says, you know, the evidence for a randomly created universe is precisely zero. Well, I would say that the evidence for a solely material explanation of human life is precisely zero. That you can describe it, but you can't explain it.
Yeah, and our knowledge always leads us to those limits where we kind of end in mystery and not knowing. Well, we're coming to the end. This has been the Zero Point Radio Show with James Moffitt from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and myself, Christopher Holmes, from up Ottawa, Ontario area. We'd like to thank BBS Radio and Seth and Don and Doug all at the radio that keep BBS going, and we appreciate all their programming. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, and let's just all around the world really come to the heart of ourselves and try to remember ourselves and wake up in these troubled times and try to be brave in facing what's upon us. And we want somehow to awaken consciousness and bring human beings into the unity of the human heart. The mind tends to always divide things and see things separately, whereas in a way it's within the mysteries of the heart that all things are interrelated and joined, and we can experience some of this interconnectedness, and mysteries are under our noses all the time. Thank you all. Keep heart. Remember yourself. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Goodbye.